So what is that song that can take you right back to a specific time and place? You can remember everything about the moment associated with hearing that song. I mean, for me, there are a lot of them. I go back to 76, Boston's More Than a Feeling. I'm riding a school bus in junior high in Pennsylvania. AC/DC's Highway to Hell. Sitting on a couch in Colorado Springs, blasting my Sirwin Vega 212 Hard Rocker speakers. If Roxy Music's More Than This comes on, I'm driving around the DC monuments in my old Mercury XR4Ti, driving too fast probably. And I could go on and on. You probably could too. That is the power of music, to transport us, to put us in a time machine, to get inside our brain and affect the chemistry, to make us feel any mood possible, to calm us down, to lift us up, to connect us, to heal us. All that stuff has been proven by science. So to kick around this topic, my very special guest is Sheryl Crow, who's been making amazing music for more than three decades. Sheryl grew up in a musical family, actually taught music to young kids, and in the course of her great career has collaborated with just about everybody to create and perform music. Everybody from Michael Jackson to Prince, Tony Bennett, Willie Nelson, Sting, Stevie Nicks, Eric Clapton, Darius Rucker, younger artists like Chris Stapleton and Maren Morris, and the great Keith Richards. Part of her Threads album, her latest album, a series of brilliant collaborations, Sheryl worked with Keith Richards, and she was transported back to her early days as a Rolling Stones fan.
It's still one of those things that I feel like a little out of body, because I think a lot of who you are when you develop as an adult is still locked into that kid, you know, and I'm still a fan, so... When I flew up to New York and worked with Keith Richards for a couple of days, I'm still that kid that's holding sticky fingers and unzipping the zipper, you know, on the album. And yet I know him and I'm friends with him, and it's, you know, 2 days of awesome, fun work. You know, with Keith, when I was a school teacher, the summer after my last year of school teaching, I went and saw him with Steve Jordan, who actually ultimately produced the record, doing Hail Hail Rock and Roll in St. Louis. They recorded it, and I was just in the audience. And so 30 years later, I'm in the studio now with Steve and Keith. So there was a lot of that sort of just surreal, energetic energy happening.
Sheryl is going to tell us a lot of great stories, including where she is right now, watching the musical awakening in her two sons. Her music, of course, cuts across all genres, rock, pop, country, R&B, jazz. You can hear her influence in so many younger artists. She sold more than 50 million records, won 9 Grammy Awards. And to Jennifer and me, she has been a dear friend for more than 15 years. She is one of my favorite people. So here we go. Musical memories with the one and only Sheryl Crow. Sheryl Crow, it is so great to see your face and hear your wisdom about the power of music as someone who's created so much powerful and beautiful music. And you have such a deep appreciation, I think, for the power of music in its many forms. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I love talking about music, especially right now, because I'm raising two little boys, and music, when I was their age, was my visionary ticket out of my hometown. You know, music's so different for everyone. And for somebody like me who grew up in a town, like every other house that had a big record player, and you read the album notes and you looked at the pictures in Rolling Stone, that was how you envisioned your life, you know, if that was what you were gravitating to. And that was definitely my story.
I'd love to hear later on about how Wyatt and Levi are learning to appreciate music and the different ways that this generation does compared to folks our age. But yeah. Music, the way it just kind of vibrates in your eardrums and gets to your brainstem and is interpreted as something special, has a power to transport, right? Like nothing else. And it can take you back to a very specific time, a very specific place in your life in a way that nothing else can. So what songs by others take you back the way that yours take your fans back to a very specific happy time and place?
Well, my kids say I was born in the Jurassic period, and that probably is true. But, you know, it's funny. I think about that, and I think, are my kids going to have that same relationship when they hear, like, a Post Malone song where they can actually, you know, completely envision where they were when they heard it? For me, like, I can hear Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty, and I can smell Mike Brown's bucket seats in his Monte Carlo, you know, and I can envision sitting at the Dairy Queen hot August night, right? I can hear Wanna Be Your Lover by Prince and thinking I was listening to like porn at a track meet in, you know, when I was a freshman in high school. You know, Wanna Be Your Lover was, I mean, that was risque. I mean, it's nothing like WAP, you know, which I'm trying to like keep my kids from seeing or hearing. And yeah, music, I think about it a lot when I think about Carlos Santana in a hotel lobby once saying, you know, watch your show, girl, you really know how to, or you really change the molecules in the room. And I've always thought about that because I do think that music is a physical experience where, you know, all the science and all the studies they've done around meditation and around music and how it changes the shape of the cell and how it can create a physical, really a physical reaction. And I do believe that. I really believe that music, it can be undersold a lot by virtue of the fact that it comes free. It has lots of video images or lots of Instagram around it, but just listening by yourself or with some friends to music is not only a physical experience, but it's a collective experience also.
Yeah, definitely want to get into that, how music connects people, revitalizes you, taps into your emotions, creates emotions. But back up a second. So Carlos freaking Santana tells you that you changed the molecules in the room based on seeing one of your live shows. There's someone who did that for a long time for millions of people. That's pretty cool. I mean, did that raise awareness in yourself of the power that your music was having?
Yeah, but you know, I think you don't think of it in terms of how you're affecting people because you're so critical of yourself. Like you come off stage and you go, well, that wasn't my best show. Or you come off stage feeling like, oh man, I totally was in it and nailed it or whatever. And it might not have been your best show. It's such a, you know, even not just listening to music, performing music is so physical. And it has so much to do with where you're at just in your psyche and what your relationship is to the energy in the room that night. So, and Carlos Santana is one of those guys that really, to me, has always been like, not just a, like a, the product of the period of hippies and making music, you know, San Francisco with that whole, that world. He's larger than that. Like he understands from a really young age how music gathers people together and how it galvanizes movements and all that sort of stuff. So to even meet the guy and so many of the heroes that I've met throughout my life who influenced me from the very beginning, it is overwhelming. But that thing that he said about the molecules that has always stuck with me because I've always wondered, you know, what is it, especially now when it's difficult for us to even stand next to a stranger without just hiding in our phones, how it is that people back then would stand in a huge crowded space, not knowing each other and be together and be connected. And that's the part of music. Well, right now for certain during COVID, I'm missing. I feel like everybody else is missing. And it's the part I think that our phones have robbed us of for really the last 10 years, just standing in a room with strangers and yet being connected. I mean, it's a little bit like being in the sanctuary of a church.
Well, totally. We experience music individually, but the power of people experience it collectively. It began with religious, mystical qualities. That's why music, I think, was first written down for that purpose. And God, yeah, we desperately miss it. I mean, I can't wait to get back to the first concert in the post-pandemic and, you know, be able to, you know, unself-consciously sing, belt out lyrics with a whole bunch of other people who are doing the same thing. And I want to get back to that because you've had the experience of standing on stage and feeling that come back to you. But I wanted to go back to the idea of music in a specific time and place, because I'll share this. Fleetwood Mac and Rumours, it came out in 77. That was the time that my family and I were relocating to Colorado to rejoin my dad, who had gone out there to be treated for cancer. So it was a tough time. We were apart for a few months. We were driving cross country in the Pontiac, Le Mans Safari wagon. Rumours was playing again and again in the cassette player. And as we kind of crested the hill and came down into Colorado Springs, those songs were playing, and it takes me right back to that feeling of a fresh start, family getting back together. Didn't even matter that Go Your Own Way or Change. Those are not exactly happy songs. Those are songs about serious angst within the band, right? They were not celebratory songs, but they were kind of upbeat in their own way. And yeah. I'll never forget, Cheryl, just that feeling, and nothing else can do that. Nothing else but music can take you back to that and make you feel the way that you did, you know, that one afternoon when you were listening in the car.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I've had the good fortune of singing Fire and Rain with James Taylor, and that is a surreal experience. But for me as a 10-year-old, you know, pouring over Mudside Slim and the Blue Horizon, that whole album, and hearing about how Fire and Rain was written about his time in a mental institution and how he was friends with this woman and she wound up committing suicide. And for a kid who's never seen the world, never seen an airplane. I mean, we weren't even like close to an airport. I still hear it, and I still can see the brown shag carpeting that I was laying on, you know, night after night, listening to those songs and envisioning myself not only as the songwriter, but as the girl. You know, it's so powerful. And, you know, I worried through the years. I don't worry about it anymore because there's nothing I can do about it. But when videos came in, I worried that it would rob all of the little listeners or even the grown-up listeners of being able to take the words and the chords and the all that goes into making a moving piece of music. It would take the listener, their experience out of it and put new images on it. You know, it would put... you know, you couldn't hear Live to Tell without seeing Madonna in the bustier and stuff, instead of Live to Tell, that incredible work of art of a song, you know. And now, you know, I wonder how much of it is so visual, but I do think that music is always going to be that thing, you know, that sets us free, that helps us find solitude, that also gives us some sense that we're not alone in our experiences. And man, James Taylor, that summer of listening to that record, and I think it was 68, 69, I think it was 68, that and Tapestry, I think that was really what set me on a course to do what I'm doing, you know, now 50 years later, or not 50 years, well, yeah, you know, I'm 58. So yeah, I was like eight.
I think it's powerful, not just the good times, because now our brains are developing. So the songs that we consume as young adults have that kind of lasting power to take us back to that time. But you know, just in talking to my co-executive producer, Jennifer, you know, for her, it also can easily bring back that feeling in the pit of her stomach of tough times. Specifically the years 84 to 88, those are not easy times for her. So we'll be driving along, and I like to listen to Sirius Radio First Wave, because for me, the songs of the 80s, you know, REM and The Police and NXS and all the songs that I played in my college radio shift, those were very good times. For her, what are you doing to me? Why are you playing that station? It's still amazing how visceral that reaction is. Then the 90s arrived and your songs, and it was a much different time for her. It was time of independence and happiness.
My songs really, I mean, fixed everything.
she was doing body shaping, personal appearances, and all the morning shows, and all they would come out in front of these big crowds, and it was always All I Want to Do and Soak Up the Sun. So
You know, it's funny. I have a difficult time listening to Coldplay, and I love them. But, you know, it's attached to a really hard time for me. And even though for me, I have no residue from that time, music still, it catalogs or indexes itself in your body. That's that I think it's a great example of how physical it is. You know, it when you get into the study of memories and how your brain catalogs memories, I really believe that music as a soundtrack is part of that. You know, no matter how you wind up thinking about those memories or feeling those memories, music is that thing that takes you back to exactly where you were. And even though you may not have like the residue from the time, you get right back into the emotion of it when you hear certain songs. And but then, you know, it's funny, then I have other like I've been in relationships where there was music that I absolutely loved. I came out of the relationship unscathed and I still love the music. So, you know, it goes all different ways. You know, I wish we could really just make a study of it and bottle what's beautiful about it.
Now it would take a long time. It's an incredibly complex, interesting topic. And yet it's something that's so simple. It's something we all can understand and recognize as humans. What was the first album that you had, that you actually went to a record store when those existed and like spent your own money? Because that's a big kind of rite of passage for people, for kids who love music. And it's not mom and dad's songs on the radio. My parents didn't play popular music. They were listening to, you know, Leonard Bernstein on the New York Philharmonic. They're, you know, college professors, very artsy. I just didn't have any cooler older brothers or sisters to introduce me. So the music I listened to in the car at home was classical or jazz. Finally, I came around and discovered, you know, pop and rock in a big way, and spent all my extra money on records. What was your first album?
First album I ever bought with my own money was ABC by the Jackson 5. And what is really ironic about that is that my first big gig after I moved to LA was with Michael Jackson. I mean, there's so many weird, I have so many weird experiences that tether later on to what I wound up doing. But yeah, I mean, they had their own cartoon TV show. They were a family. My family was very, very musical. My mom and dad were in a swing band. I mean, it was amateur, but they would come home and play with all their friends after they would do a gig. And they played everything from like you said, show tunes, but they played everything from big band music to, I mean, they would play James Taylor. They would play Stevie Wonder. They were extremely diverse in their music choices. And that was wonderful for me. And my older sisters were super cool because they had record collections. But ABC and the Jackson 5, I looked at that and I went, wow, we could do that. We could be that, you know, and we didn't wind up being that, but I did wind up going on and working with him. And then the second record I ever bought actually was, maybe it wasn't the second record, but it tied into the first concert I ever saw, which was Peter Frampton. And it was Frampton Comes Alive. It was that tour. And man, just the bigness of that and how that had seeped through popular culture and being a lifeguard and a teenager. And, you know, do you feel like I feel? I still, when I hear that, I'm just like, I'm a kid again. I'm a teenager, totally body conscious, seeing boys, being a lifeguard, you know, it's all that goes into that album for me.
You had great taste even back then, Cheryl. Those are pretty good choices. Or ABC and Frampton Comes Alive. For me, it was, I think, Band on the Run, Paul McCartney and Wings. It was the first album I recall spending my own money on and just, you know, playing the shit out of it forever until the grooves were just kind of worn out. But that was just a cool thing. You know, this is, I'm making a choice. I'm going to the record store. I got this, you know, big piece of cardboard with a piece of vinyl inside. Kids now don't experience that. I want to go to the Michael Jackson thing because it's amazing that that was your first record. And then you began to sort of experience the power of music on this incredibly large scale when you're singing back up on that tour and singing I Just Can't Stop Loving You, a duet where now the focus is on you and Michael, and your 75,000 faces are right there singing. And there's a girl from Kennett, Missouri, kind of experiencing this. I think it was probably your first time abroad, right? And now here you are in front of all these people.
I mean, I had to actually,
what did that feel like?
I had to get a passport. I mean, I'd never been out of the country. In fact, I was a school teacher before that. And I basically was like, okay, I'm going to go to LA or I'm going to go to New York. LA seems nicer. I'm going to go there. And I crashed the audition, long story short. And I wound up getting it. And, you know, that's an interesting thing too, because I feel like what I witnessed with Michael and the power of music was so much bigger, and also having watched him since he was younger than me. I mean, he was 5 and 6 years old when you would see him on, TV variety shows, singing these like Frank Sinatra songs, you know, and singing Ben, and then doing this incredible R&B that we all grew up with. And then I went up singing with him, and to watch how people would just lose their shit. I mean, it was like they were witnessing a deity, you know. And there's something, I guess that's a whole other show, but it's so weird to see. It was a little bit like watching what was going on with the Beatles, you know, all that old footage of people passing out and girls crying. But the thing that was interesting to me was standing behind him and seeing, you could just see in him that fragile little guy who was so damaged. But then when he would step into something bigger than him, you just could feel like, okay, there's a difference between ego and the divinity. And the art part of it, certainly, I mean, if you believe in God or something bigger, that's where that comes in. And that's where all those people, 75,000 strangers, are just wrapped up in the molecular thing that Carlos Santana talks about, you know, and they come away from that feeling changed. And that for me was an incredible thing to witness. I mean, I'll never know what that's like to have my whole life be based on that, being a small child and being so famous. But watching that was powerful for me, as seeing what music can be and how it can wield a lot of emotion and power and strength.
Yeah, I mean, powerful, intoxicating, inspiring, a cautionary tale, I'm sure, as well. It's kind of the whole package. So when you are now playing your own songs and you are in the spotlight and their faces are looking at you and singing back words that you wrote on a bass in some lonely time and place years ago, and it's different generations that are doing it. I mean, for those of us that will never know what that's like, you're doing a job up there. You got to play the song, but do you ever just allow yourself to take all that in?
Chris, it's interesting watching all those men out there crying and passing out
and fainting. Yes.
Fainting,
throwing underwear on the stage. Yeah. Yeah.
Find their underwear. It's different when you're a girl rock star. You don't get the perks that the guys get. But yeah, I mean, there was a time early on when I really was feeling pretty burnt out that I couldn't see the audience as being a sort of a benevolent being. You know, I always felt like the critics were after me. And then I wound up being diagnosed with breast cancer, and it totally reset everything. I wanted the lights on all the time. I wanted to make contact with people and their faces and their eyes and their stories. And, there is a really odd thing that happens when you have a hit song and you travel to other countries where they don't even speak your language, like Japan or whatever, and you see them doing their best to sing along. They know the words in a totally different language, and just how, it's not like anything you can ever measure as a kid as to what you perceive success would be like. You know, like to me, I did pore over rumors, and I did get my hair cut in a total shag. And I was like intrigued with Stevie Nicks maybe being a witch. And, you know, I got the shawls and I wanted to be that, you know. And that was, to me, I didn't envision like the audience. I always envisioned me as her. It's a different thing when you're on stage and there are nights where you feel overwhelmed with the energy that's coming back at you. And then there are other nights where you feel like, this is a job and am I in this? And I don't want to shortchange anybody. You know, I think after breast cancer and kind of rebooting my life and who I was and who I saw myself as, I could really feel the enjoyment of going out and sharing as opposed to having to deliver.
Was a perspective change in you that made you want to walk out there, turn on the house lights, let's see the faces, let's not sing to the dark, let's appreciate and enjoy that connection? That's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a mythology, or I mean, I think for some people maybe it's not mythology, for some people it probably is true, that you have to write a great song, you have to be a tortured figure. And In fact, it's funny because, and Stevie and I have laughed about this. Stevie always said, as soon as you have kids, you never write a great song again. And I felt like after I adopted Wyatt and after I adopted Levi, but some of my best, most open stuff started coming out. Obviously, tides were changing and everything was being geared towards really young artists. I felt the liberation of and the joy of making music, that it was bigger than a profession. I mean, obviously I was lucky that I was there in the early days and was successful and sold records, as opposed to now when you don't sell records anymore. But it's, you know, it's a gift. It's one of those things I look at and I think I can't imagine not doing it, even if I never get to go out on stage again. It's just a part, it's a part of who I am, and part of who I am is, that part of me is, I think, a lot of times where my joy is.
You know, you, first of all due respect to Stevie Nicks, plenty of great songs have been written by people that have kids.
Oh yeah.
We all evolve. It's one of those things you say that sounds like cute at the time, and then you realize it's just bullshit because there's so much that comes later in life that's a rich substance for storytelling. Cheryl, you mentioned breast cancer and difficult. You've been through some tough times. We all have. We're not aware of what everyone we see has had that stuff happen. And you said that you've had your own music, the creation of music, which is not a gift that a lot of us have. Sometimes you just listen to music when we're sad or going through tough times. You've been able to create it, whether it's, you know, sitting at a piano to your left there, or the guitars that are behind you, or whatever the instrument is, and kind of put your sadness there and either have it dissipate or have something great come out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think with anything that you love, if it's also your work, then it becomes about your productivity, and it becomes about how successful that thing that you put out is. And then you measure that. You know, it's like if you work in an office and you have to hand in a big report and it doesn't really wind up serving any great purpose, or if you're doing a thesis and you get a B minus, it's like, instead of the joy of doing it, you measure the success of it by the rating of it. And it's the same in music. It's the same in anything. You know, for a long time there, if a record that I made didn't come out in the top 10 or didn't make it up into the top 10, it was like a bomb. And that created a lot of pressure to continue to be successful. And, you know, I am lucky that I go to work and do the thing that I love, but I don't want the thing that I love to feel so much like work that I don't love it anymore. And there has been that, and that is true probably of everything. You know, there's a point where you have to step away and go, okay, who am I? How much of who I am in my life revolves around what I do? And at which point I could kind of walk away and say, if I never did this again, I'm still a happy person and I matter. And, you know, and it just takes, sometimes it takes things being jerked to a standstill for you to realize, oh, wait, I am a person. And after that, I'm an artist, you know? And so,
what was the moment when you got back to sort of the power of music and you separated the commerce from it? And it was falling in love with the process again, the creation, the thing, if no one ever heard or bought, who gives a shit? Because the creation of it was the thing and the enjoyment in that whole process.
Well, I mean, I think a couple of times. First and foremost, when I made the Detours record, after I had breast cancer and had gone through some stuff in my personal life, I took about an 8 or 10 month break where I wouldn't allow myself to go to a piano or a guitar or a notebook, because I thought, you know, I've just spent so many years going to music to be the thing that gets me out of experiencing whatever it is. And at which point I got ready to open my mouth again. I had a 3 month old, and that definitely paints the world differently. And at the time I started seeing what was happening in our government, George Bush, we had 9/11. We went into Iraq, which seemingly was based on, nothing connected to 9/11.
You have a 3 month old, but Detours is a very political record, right? I mean, right from the first song, you're dealing with stuff that's pissing you off about where our country is.
Yeah. And I think part of it was because everything felt so much more personal to me. I was like, wait a minute. I got a 3 month old who's going to live far longer than I'm going to live to see how this all plays out, you know, to see how the environment, you know, what we're, the fact that we're just ignoring it. You know, obviously Al Gore had lost the race, or seemingly lost the race, to George Bush. And it was just like everything went on the back burner. We're going into Iraq. We love our oil. And I have this newborn and I'm just like, what the, you know? And the record really was, to me, it was just like a grown-up record. It was a record that was like, I don't care about radio. This record is addressing what me and my grown-up friends are talking about and our concerns as parents and blah, blah, blah. I handed it into the record label and they're like, wow, this is really a record. And we don't know what to do with this and nobody wants to hear this. And
it's a great record, by the way.
Thank you. And I was like, wow. And so anyway, they put the record out and I got dropped and that was fine. And then after that, I really felt like, oh, wow, I'm totally liberated. I don't have a record label. I'm just going to make a record and see who wants to put it out. And since then, it's been like that. It's, you know, Threads, I didn't have a record label. And the Be Myself record we made in 3 weeks. I mean, it was just like, oh, I can't wait to get down here. I dropped the kids off at school. And I would, you know, I would write and record until I pick them up and then they'd come hang out down here and we'd eat dinner. And 3 weeks later, I had a record and they were like, wow, this is what you do for a living, Mom. We just thought you went out on stage with too much makeup on and acted like a turd bucket. That's what they call me. A turd. You have to act like a turd bucket out there. You work, like you go into work and you work at it. I'm like, yeah, that's what you do. Some days you gotta face the light, get back in the ring, put on your gloves and fight. I think it's gonna take some time to find a way to ease my mind. I'm gonna take the long way back home.
I love what you said. It's very interesting to me that you stepped away for 8 or 10 months because you didn't want music to be the therapy. You know, Carl Jung said that he thinks music should be an essential part of every therapy, but you can overdo it. You can use it as a crutch, I guess, if it becomes something that's the easy way out. It's interesting. You know, everybody on the planet's been through so much, you know, experiencing it individually, the pandemic, but also there's so many common threads and people have been turning to music in very different ways. I had my nocturnal walk pandemic soundtrack where I wasn't trying to feel better. I wasn't trying to pretend everything was good. I was kind of, if not marinating, at least sort of just allowing the sadness and the despair and the confusion and the alienation, all that stuff to kind of come in. So it's Radiohead, Paranoid Android, and I play Comfortably Numb and songs by Sturgill Simpson is an artist that I love. And
I love Sturgill.
There's a band called War on Drugs. It's not well known, but they had a song called Pain. And I would just play it. Or Leonard Cohen, Cheryl, was one too. You know, sometimes you're sitting in here, you're watching CNN and you're seeing everything that's going on. And you know, he has lines, I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. I'm neither left nor right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost on that hopeless little screen. And I thought, God, yes, that is exactly what I'm feeling. He wrote it a long time ago at something else. And that is exactly what I'm feeling. And I would go for these walks and play it. But then we'd get hopeful, you know. But I'm as stubborn as those garbage bags that cannot be decayed. I'm junk, but I'm still holding this little wild bouquet. And it's like, okay, I felt the sadness and all that stuff and the frustration. But then there was that little hopeful nugget at the end of the song, which so many songs have.
I love that because I think, you know, there's a study that came out a few years ago on NPR. I listened to it on NPR. It didn't come out on NPR, but a couple of guys did a study about our attention span and how pop music, it's all geared around 6 seconds. And you have to either have a great hook or something to keep the listener engaged. Otherwise, after 6-7 seconds, they're going to turn the radio station or turn the channel or whatever. And just hearing you say that, I know deep in my heart, and I've seen it with my 13-year-old, that words and even the structure of chords and melody penetrate, and you want to hear it again, and you hear yourself in it, and you feel like you're not alone. And that's what music and art has always done. I mean, all the way back to hieroglyphics, it's helped us to understand who we are in the grand cosm of things. And it makes us feel like we're not alone. It makes us feel like somebody out there understands what I'm going through. And we made a trip recently down to Florida after everything shut down last year. And you know, interesting time for little boys who are growing up with screens and lots of activities and sports and stuff. And then suddenly everything shut down and they're not going to school. And it became really a simple time for us. And this is two little boys who've spent every summer on tour buses and have seen the world and have seen the United States every, you know, and then all of a sudden we're home and they're building a chicken coop. And my 13-year-old who plays bass discovered the Beatles all on his own. Now, you know, I play stuff on Spotify and they're like, ugh, what are you listening to? That is Ray Charles. Get out of my hair, you know? And he found it on his own, Eleanor Rigby, and he listened to it over and over. And I see in him what I experienced as a child too, that sense of melancholy that you can't figure out why you have it when you're like, my 10-year-old doesn't have that at all. But my 13-year-old has that thing that I related to as a young kid, a sense of melancholy for something that, I don't know, something that you miss, something that doesn't exist or whatever. And that's where music gets in and is soothing to the soul and does create hope, or, you know, gives you a respite from the stress or the concern and lifts you up. It's just, it is an undeniable physical experience.
Yeah. Eleanor Rigby. Lyrics are about as sad as it gets. You know, all the lonely people, where do they all come from? I mean, where do they all belong? It's interesting that Wyatt found that song. I think in many, many millions of people have found songs like that. And it's not that it necessarily instantly makes you feel better. It just reinforces or maybe introduces you to the idea that not only you're not alone, but many, many, many people have felt those things and do feel those things.
Yeah. And, you know, for our young kids, there will be songs that will feel sad, and that will be the thing. Like, as a mom, I go, oh, he's in a, not a dark place, but he's feeling emotion. And that's what you want. I mean, people need to feel emotion. We don't want to be desensitized. And with all the information, all the gadgets and all the distractions and stuff, it's dangerous for us to be desensitized. It's dangerous for every song that our pop, you know, comes out on pop radio is about sex and stuff, because our kids need to feel. We people, you know, as a nation, we need to feel. We need to wear our emotions on the outside, and not just the anger and the frustration, which is super easy to go to, but the vulnerability.
When you do for money this job that is about creation, and we talk about the power of music, it's easy to have the lines blurred, I would imagine, between what your life is and what you do for a living, because music is a part of all of that. How have you found that? A job that is so powerful, that is so, can be also all consuming, inspiring, but is not the sum total of who you are as a person creating music.
I just really like music, and especially, you know, younger years, earlier years, I would listen to music from the standpoint of not only a fan, but also somebody who was learning. Like, I would listen to music and it was like it wasn't necessarily all about the joy of it. It was about learning and getting better and analyzing. And now there's so much music out there that is so good. That I'm excited. I want to keep going. I feel like my best work's in front of me. And especially after the Threads record and being able to work with artists that have inspired me and that are continuing to inspire me and to continue to make great music. And there's so many young artists like Brandy and Chris Stapleton, Gary Clark Jr., Jason Isbell, Maren, you know, there's Sturgill, for crying out loud. There's so much good stuff out there, and we're lucky in Nashville because we have a radio station called Lightning 100, and they play music that is, you know, it's not all programmed, and you know, Courtney Barnett and Lucius, and they play stuff that you listen to and you go, oh, damn, wish I would have written that, you know, and that's what I love. I'm also really lucky in that when quarantine hit, it gave me time to sit down and play again. You know, just to sit and play the guitar. My kids are like, why are you playing the guitar? I'm like, because I really like it. And they're, you know, they always have always seen it as, oh, she's working. But I still really love it, you know, and I'm really hopeful about it, where we are at as a people, because as bad as it is, I know that what comes out of all of this will be something glorious. And I want to be there for that. And I want to be able to write about it. I want to be a documentarian about it. And that, I think, is where art comes in. You know, you walk through the Louvre and the colors, the images, you may not understand them, but they do help you to understand your emotion. And the same with, and more so with music, you know, being alone and hearing a song can be the thing that makes you not feel alone. And that reminds you of who you are. It reminds you of your essence. And that is the great hope. And I think that we will get back to a point where we're not concerned about 6 seconds. And we will get back to a point where we're not writing songs for the advertisers. And that's where I'm hopeful.
I love the hopeful message. I hope you're right.
Yeah. We'll always have singer-songwriters. We'll always have artists, and because we need them. And there's a place for that.
You talk about the music you made recently. You're sitting in that beautiful studio. You also mentioned horses. I believe the horses are right below you, right? This is the studio above the stable.
Yes.
I love that building.
Yes, they are.
So you're doing, I want to get to the collaborations you did with these friends of yours and these musical geniuses, because Threads is an extraordinary piece of work. But it was recorded in large part, right, above where those horses are. Did the horses have any feedback? Did they have any say in what was going on? They must be hearing the vibrations from, you know, in the ceiling above them and the floor of your studio.
Very, very mellow horses. They have like the nice smell of weed wafting through the barn. No, but I, on more than one occasion, I've had to go down there and say, will you turn that damn leaf blower off? You know, like, can we clean stalls some other time? For crying out loud. You know, it's a pretty cool, it's a cool vibe here. It's not at all commercial. It is an actual working barn. And initially I wanted to create just like a little writing space where I could record. And by the time we soundproofed it and moved everything up here, it was a full blown studio. So it's been a good vibe, and I've had lots of friends record up here. And so I'm just collecting that good juju in the walls and in the instruments that I'm pulling out for my own stuff. And it's a good vibe. I mean, I think if you can work from your home, you're in a pretty good situation. And while a lot of people I know are frustrated with working from home, for me, it's been a real blessing.
The collaborative power of music, where not being experienced by strangers out there, but being experienced by those of you that are making it sort of in the moment. I mean, that must have been an incredible experience, because in Threads, you're working with, you mentioned some of the younger artists, but also the legends like Kris Kristofferson and Willie Nelson, Keith Richards, a friend of yours. I mean, Eric Clapton, Bonnie Raitt, all these other people. So when you're with someone like that, whether it's creating something from thin air, writing a song or performing it, you know, for the record, out of body experience or very much in body present experience, or what's that like when musical forces kind of combine like that?
It's still one of those things that I feel like a little out of body, because I think a lot of who you are when you develop as an adult is still locked into that kid, you know, and I'm still a fan. So when I flew up to New York and worked with Keith Richards for a couple of days, I'm still that kid that's holding sticky fingers and unzipping the zipper, you know, on the album. And yet I know him and I'm friends with him, and it's, you know, 2 days of awesome, fun work and watching the debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And, you know, life is happening while you're working with this hero. And there were a lot of those moments, you know, with Keith. When I was a school teacher, the summer after my last year of school teaching, I went and saw him with Steve Jordan, who actually ultimately produced the record, doing Hail Hail Rock and Roll in St. Louis. They recorded it, and I was just in the audience. And so 30 years later, I'm in the studio now with Steve and Keith. And so there was a lot of that a lot of that sort of just surreal, energetic energy happening. And with Chris, though, Chris Christopherson, he was the first person I asked to be a part of this. And it was because I'd gone and recorded some with him, because his memory was starting to betray him. I mean, not, you know, he wasn't making new memories anymore. And Lisa, his wife, asked me if I would come and record some of his masters with him. And when I came away from that experience, I was just like, man, this is somebody I've known for 25 years. He's been a, you know, monumental influence on me. And to be able to stand there with him and him tell stories about songs from the 60s, 70s, you know, who played on what and what, you know, just incredible stories, but then not to be able to remember that we had just recorded it 5 minutes before. It gave me a sense of how not just fragile, how fleeting moments are, and that a lifetime is made up of moments. And I just thought, you know, this is what I want my musical experience to be about now, is capturing that. And that's what the album was. And there were a lot of very surreal moments of singing with Johnny Cash, who isn't here anymore, and feeling the presence, you know, his alive presence while I'm singing. And just
your song, by the way, singing your song,
singing my song that he had recorded before he passed away, two months before he passed away, and having sung at June's funeral right before that, and then ultimately singing at his funeral, and then to sing it, and with all that was happening in the United States, this crazy ugliness that was going on, and this chaos and this lostness during the election, and this sort of trying to define who we were as people, and not recognizing us, and then singing that song with him late at night and feeling the profundity of that.
Yeah, that's an otherworldly experience to listen to that track. People need to get Threads, because all these surreal experiences you recall in the moment produce some extraordinary music and some very cool stuff. And that's an awesome gift that you got to experience to yourself and also to fans. You talked about Chris Christopherson, you know, the power of music to try to keep tethered to our past selves, people who are struggling with dementia and Alzheimer's. Sometimes the music, I think, and laughter are both so important. In the saddest times, you have to have both of them. I'll tell a quick story, because I visited my mom in the senior center for folks who are suffering from Alzheimer's. And as they do in most places, they play music, because even though you can't remember what you had for lunch, they can remember songs, lyrics from 50 years ago. And Jennifer and I walked in there, and there was a young girl performing songs, and the faces of these seniors were all lit up, and they were enjoying it. But this is black comedy, so forgive me if you don't laugh at this, but we found you have to laugh at this stuff. And here's this young girl singing a song from my favorite musical, which is Les Mis. And one of my favorite songs in it early in the show, I Dreamed a Dream. And unironically, she's singing the lyrics, you know, I dreamed a dream my life would be so different from this hell I'm living. So different now from what it seems. Now life has killed the dream I dreamed. And, you know, it's, yes, music has a power. But you have to laugh, right? It was sad, but it was beautiful at the same time, because they were singing this song with no sense of irony, but... I'm sorry if that's too dark.
There's something so Bill Murray and Saturday Night Live about that. Oh my gosh, that is hilarious. Yeah, you know, I remember that movie Awakenings, and the scene where they're all up dancing and stuff. And I know that in memory nursing homes, they play a lot of music, and they see people really light up, and sort of in some ways they come back into themselves. And that to me is just a perfect experience of, you know, what Carlos Santana is talking about, just the physical, but watching it with Chris and watching him, I mean, it's the last thing that goes. I saw Glenn Campbell play as well, and watched that documentary. And I think that music there is residue from music. I think it does index in your body, and it's the last thing that goes, I think, with these artists who've had a life in music. They find themselves in music, and then when that starts to go, then it's kind of
It's one of the first things too, though. You taught music to young kids. If you think about how we learn the alphabet, You learn your ABCs to music because there's a power in that to sort of get in your head. And you saw at the other end of, you know, the circle of life, you saw very young kids and be able to turn them on to music. So you go from seeing a distinguished artist trying to hold on to it to kids who are just kind of have it sparked for the first time. What was that like trying to, you know, be the one that was helping them understand music is fun. This is going to be a powerful thing for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was in college and doing my student teaching, I had several experiences that were totally eye-opening to me. And I did not wind up going into music therapy, but I took a music therapy class and we worked with kids who were autistic and or severely mentally handicapped. And a lot of them were non-communicative. And yet the vibrations of a drum or, you know, different, you know, playing music in a very dark, closed off child, it, you know, it's like you've shined a light on them, and to watch that physical reaction, music therapy has been kind of a lifeline for a lot of those kids. But for me teaching elementary kids, man, that's just joy. I mean, even last week, Levi came home and he is trying to learn all of his prepositions. I think there's like 42 prepositions, and they put it to a song, you know, and he got an A, got all of his prepositions because he could sing it, you know, and even, I mean, my most joyful memories of my boys, and even teaching, but watching kids move to music, they're not self-conscious of their bodies yet. They're just moving, you know, and it's just there. I don't know that there's anything more precious than watching children move to music and being completely uninhibited. I hate that as we grow older, we become so inhibited and so self-conscious that we don't, you know, we don't move like that. But when they're little, music just is this overwhelming energy infuser, you know?
And before they have TikTok and they're concerned about how many likes they're going to get for the dance that they're doing.
Exactly.
There's that before sweet spot in there.
Money. Yeah. They make money off of their moves. They're simulating pole dancing before they learn what twerking is.
You talked about just music as its experience. I love the story that to try to feel what the great Stevie Wonder was feeling when he was composing and performing music, he used to play it in the dark and play his stuff on the piano just to make it remove all the senses except what you were kind of feeling through your music. What an interesting, cool experience. I've never heard anything like that.
Yeah, I don't really know. You know, I can only say, you know, I remember talking to my brother about this when I was adopting my boys. I was like, you know, it's funny, when you adopt, you don't really know what you're getting. And I remember him saying, oh, when you have your own biological kids, you don't know what you're getting. And when I think about me as a kid and doing that, of going in and turning off all the lights and playing the piano, that strong sense of melancholy, I came in with it. Not everybody does. And I gravitated to playing songs on the piano. But that feeling of wanting to be in the dark and understanding that the soul is playing the keys, not the thinking part of your, you know. And how did Stevie Wonder do that? How did he write "Love's in Need of Love Today" and find those chords that for a person who's feeling, you know, an undefinable sadness, how he could find those chords in the dark? And I wanted to understand that because I wanted to be able to find my way through the dark. And that's what it meant for me.
Well, we've talked about music at the beginning of life, the end of life, and a lot in between. And it's been fun. I'll leave with this. This is not meant to be a morbid question, but more of a celebration of what we find most precious and most valuable. People talk about the last meal. What's your last meal going to be?
Yeah.
Not because you're necessarily focusing on death, but because that's what you appreciate the most. So while you're eating the last meal, last album, Cheryl, what's the last album that you want to kind of experience before running to the light and going to the next realm?
Well,
I know it's not an easy question.
Oh my gosh, there's so many albums that I love that I will listen to top to bottom still. But I would say All Things Must Pass, which actually, I mean, if you're dying, All Things Must Pass does pretty much say it all. But
the last song? Maybe album's kind of hard, but maybe last song is an easier thing for anyone listening to this to kind of hold on to.
Wow, last song.
And it's easy to say. I could, you know, like you
oh
could say.
Oh my gosh, this is so good. It sounds so, so corny, but this just pops into my mind because when I was a kid, we had this thing called the Great Book, which a lot of musicians will know what that is. They made several volumes of the Great Book and they were like the classics. And my sisters and I used to always sing "On the Sunny Side of the Street." That's going to be it. I mean, because I remember it from an early age and it still feels the same, you know, singing it, and it just ushers you on to the next.
I'm not sure where we can go from there. That's a beautiful sum up of the power of music. You know, the way that it's not, people say it doesn't get in. It's just always in there. It's always been in there. It just has to come out. And sometimes a song or an artist can do that. So.
Yeah, it does. And it, you know, I love the idea that it helps us figure out who we are and help us find our way.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. You shared so much. That was fun. The time goes by very quickly. We could do this for a long time, but your passion, your love of it.
I have an idea. Let's do it by the pool with a margarita.
That's the only thing we can make this better.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a deal. Thanks, Cheryl. Love you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris. Love you too.
That was so much fun for me. I hope you enjoyed it. And who knows? Maybe the sequel Cheryl suggested. Poolside with cocktails, maybe that'll happen sometime down the road. Music for me has been as important a part of life as sports or anything else. An upcoming episode in this pod series is going to be about music in TV shows, from The Sopranos to Sesame Street and beyond. Special guests Mike Mills of REM and Brian Koppelman, co-creator, showrunner, co-writer of Showtime's Billions, among many other credits in TV, film, and music. So keep an ear out for that. My thanks to Cheryl and her management team and to co-writer Jeff Trott for clearance and usage of the two musical tracks. As always, thanks to my co-executive producer Jennifer Dempster and producer Jason Weichel. Appreciate your listening. We'd love it if you subscribe, review, and leave feedback on my Instagram. I'd appreciate that. Talk to you soon.